Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I'm your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the RIP Lawrence Weed Show, and I am dead serious about this. And I'm sorry to say dead serious, but I am dead serious about this. Lawrence Weed was a great, great medical educator and a very inventive medical mind. We'll talk more about him in a minute. Sorry to see him die at age 93. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. And here to support me in my wake for Lawrence Weed from the University of Kentucky Physician Assistant Program, Assistant Professor Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And also from UK's, from the deep in the bowels of the university.
Information Technology Services. That's all you got to say, Tony. It's easy.
The Interim Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, Rick Phillips. And Rick will explain to you how you can access Health Matters on the web. Take it away, Rick.
Well, if you want to listen to the show, Moorhead State Public Radio has a website for you. It's WMKY.org. Just navigate through the menus, find Health Matters. There you will get a list of all the most recent shows. There's a little summary there. There's a link to a podcast. There's a link to the actual audio from the show. Listen to it. Read about it over and over and over. It's there for your listening pleasure. After you've listened to the show, it's time to interact with us. Yes, we do offer a two-way communication mechanism. We're not just a radio station that blasts out one-way audio. We give you the option to feedback. Facebook.com/HMRadioShow. It's a fan page. We all get on there and check and post and talk, and it's your way to interact with Health Matters. Send us some show topics. Send us some feedback. Tell us what you like, what you don't like. Got a question? We'll probably answer it, although I'm probably going to make fun of it, and Tony's going to, well, he probably will answer something.
I will still giggle. If you make fun of it, I'll giggle, but then we'll try to give you a serious answer.
And then every once in a while, things just come across either on the show or during the week through a crazy newscast or something, and we'll post that up there for, just to kind of get your attention. So, again, if you want to interact with Health Matters, jump on Facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
Our sponsor for the show today is the Know Your Internal Organs Working Cluster. Today's organ is the liver. If you want to live, you need a liver.
Is there any of those sentences that start with, if you need to live, you don't need your whatever?
If you want to live, you need a liver. Well, you can do without a kidney. You can do without a lung. Yeah, but you can do without an arm or a leg. Mm-hmm. You may give your arm or leg to get a lung or never mind. But at any rate, if you want to live, you need a liver. And that's the working cluster. The Know Your Internal Organs working cluster. And we've got 11 fun facts about the human liver. I condensed these from the June 15th New York Times article about titled An Inside Peek at the Weird, Wondrous Human Liver. We're going to go through first four or five in this fractional portion, and we'll go, as we always do, in the second and third. The human liver is the largest organ in the body. Next to the brain, it performs the most distinct functions. The Elizabethans historically referred to their monarch not as the head of state, but as the liver of state.
Really?
I like that. Yeah, and if you have a lily-livered leader, their cowardice will prove their undoing. The use, and that leads to fun fact number three, the first known use of the word lily-livered was in 1605, not in a spaghetti western, surprisingly. From the medieval belief that the liver was the seat of courage and the pale color of a lily flower would mean that your liver is not to have much blood in it and you would have no courage and you would be a coward. Fun fact number four. According to the New York Times, we have, I'm quoting the New York Times now, we have mechanical ventilators to breathe for you if your lungs fail, dialysis machines if your kidneys fail, and the heart is mostly just a pump, so we have an artificial heart. But if your liver fails, there is no machine to replace its different functions. All you can do is get a transplant. And so you cannot go hook yourself to an artificial liver. We simply do not have that technology. Number five, we'll stop there. The liver is the only organ in the adult body that, after being chopped down, can rapidly regenerate and perform as if new. Amazing thing is the liver cells actually contained very rich DNA. We'll talk more about that in our next fractional portion. And they are able to divide and to restore to a certain degree. I mean, you can't just take the liver out and leave a small nubbin and have it grow a new liver. But you can take out a pretty sizable portion of the liver, and it will grow back. That's our sponsor, the Know Your Internal Organs Working Cluster. I want to tell you a little bit about Lawrence Weed. Because this man was, for those of us who are farther along in medicine, this man was a great man and a visionary. He died June 3rd, age 90, I think he was 93. But what I remember from him was something called the problem-oriented medical record. Now, if you look at medical records, they first were organized by physician. And when I was in my training, I went to a family practice place, and he organized it by patient, but he still just wrote little one-line entries in his charts. And I was doing a problem-oriented medical record, and I realized I was much different from this family physician. Back over 100 years ago, the Mayo brothers at the Mayo Clinic decided you could not organize your notes by physician. You couldn't say, these are the patients I saw on Tuesday. You really needed to organize your notes by patient. So they started compiling a chart on each patient. Now, those charts were pretty rudimentary. I saw him. I gave him a penicillin shot. I saw him. I fixed his hand, things like that. But they at least were organized by patient. But the genius of Lawrence Weed, he said, look, you know, we have patients with chronic illnesses. We can't simply just record what we do on a single day. We need to note all the chronic problems that they have. We need to address these problems each visit. It may be that we're not going to check labs on this problem today. It may be we're not going to change medicines, but we need to be aware of this problem. So I can look at a chart and see what's wrong with a patient. And the way, again, the family physician that I work with, the way he did it, he simply, you could not look at that chart. You would have to read the entire chart to figure out what was wrong with the patient. Weed had a problem list on the left-hand side of his chart, and he charted according to those problems. And so if you wanted to know about any problem, you could go back through his notes and see what had been happening with it. It seems simple today, but it was an absolutely marvelous way to document scientifically what a doctor did and also to orient a doctor's thinking toward all these different problems. I used it in the ICU. It would save people's lives because I could consider all the problems the patient had rather than just the most important one that I was thinking about on that day. Unfortunately, our electronic medical records sort of undid that. They're primarily a billing document. They do organize things by problem, but they contain so much fluff in them that advances were lost. From 1969 to 1981, essentially throughout the 1970s, he was a professor at the University of Vermont. He led a multimillion-dollar federally funded research project to computerize his problem-oriented medical information system. It was called PROMIS. The idea of trying to create a computerized medical record in the 1970s is astoundingly forward-thinking. I wish he had gotten farther along because the record we've got now is just trash. And it would be nice to see what a genius like Lawrence Weed could have done. So he passes. We mourn his passing at age 93. He lived a triumphant life. He was a brilliant person and a medical leader and a person that had a lot to do with the way I made my notes when I got out of medical school. Next up, we put this on our Facebook page because we wanted to remind those of you who get tattoos that tattoos, in fact, are open wounds on your flesh, and you have to take care of them. This came from CNN June 2nd, a 31-year-old man. It was reported in the BMJ Case Reports Journal. We get several of our case reports out of that one where they talk about people that had unusual things happen to them. He wanted to get a tattoo. He was 31 years old, wanted to get a tattoo on his right leg. He got an illustration of a cross, hands in prayer, the word Jesus is my life, were written in cursive on his leg. Now, there's some things you need to know when you get a tattoo. One is you've got to keep it cleaned and covered while the skin has this susceptibility to infection. They have punctured your skin numerous times with a needle. That's an open wound, and germs can enter that open wound, so you've got to keep the thing clean. One of the things that is absolutely forbidden for a brand new tattoo is soaking it. A very quick shower, sometimes with it covered, but do not soak it, and never, never, never swimming. Unfortunately, this man, who was in Texas, I believe, he decided to go swimming, but not swimming anywhere. He went swimming in the Gulf of Mexico. That water is not pristine, and 5 days after he got his tattoo, he went for a swim. 3 days after the swim, he was admitted to Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas. Severe pain in his legs and feet, fever, redness around the tattoo, and redness elsewhere on the legs. In fact, he had gotten a Vibrio infection. Vibrio is the germ you get from eating raw oysters. But in his case, he had gotten it directly from the water, they presume, through this tattoo, because it was an open wound. He went into septic shock. He was on a breathing machine for the first 18 days, improved a little bit, and then he worsened again. And 2 months after admission, 2 months after he was admitted, he died, having never gone home from the hospital. One of the problems was he also drank a bit. His liver was not fully, and we go back to the liver we talked about, the amazing liver. His liver was not fully functional, and he did not have all of his tools his immune system could have had to fight this thing off. But unfortunately, a man gets a tattoo, a man goes swimming, and a man dies after 2 months in the hospital as a result. It's a tragic occurrence. You know, you got to protect those tattoos. You cannot immediately after a tattoo, you can't just walk out of the tattoo parlor and assume nothing's going on.
And the thing is, I feel certain they either give you a piece of paper or they give you instructions or tell you. And I had a tattoo, and they told me that, 30 years ago. So I can't imagine that the tattoos are not an open wound anymore.
No.
The thing is, it's deceptive because it's not like open. It bleeds.
Right.
It's like oozes.
It's multiple needle sticks, and so the skin is not peeled back or anything. You're right about that. They were not able to ask him whether he understood the instructions for care of a tattoo. They really just don't know. But he obviously, you're right. I mean, this is supposed to be the standard when you get a tattoo to get these instructions, that it is a wound and it needs wound care.
I'm surprised you don't have one, Tony. Or are you just keeping a closed lip over there? You're not telling anybody?
I do not have a tattoo. You were military, and I understand that. Tattoos are usually drunk or military.
Well,
there were guys with me
that had both of those symptoms.
Yeah. Now, I would say, for our generation, now I made a very, very inflammatory statement there for the younger generation, where they are many things. But for our generation, if you were sober and not in the military, you were not as likely to have a tattoo.
Right.
Now, I've heard people say I ought to get a tattoo now that my regular body doesn't look quite as handsome as it used to.
I have to admit, yours won't look that funny in 20 years,
Yeah.
Because you're probably not going to change that much.
What's sagged has sagged, and
right.
So now I can get a tattoo to kind of take advantage of that.
My good news is when I got the tattoo, I paid, $40 or whatever it was, and now my tattoo is the size of a $200 tattoo.
Rick's
so really, I'm ahead
economy
if you count
tattoos
for inflation.
Here.
If you count for inflation, I'm good.
I understand, but it is an oddity. Well, it's just come into fashion. But young people, absolutely beautiful bodies, decide that they need to enhance them somehow. And I'm thinking, I'm probably the guy that needs to enhance my body.
So Tony, the funny thing about me was we were all a few of us went to go get tattoos, and we all kind of talked each other into it, right? So it was one of those dumb kid things. And, I go back and I thank my lucky stars. I had at least of all the four guys, I felt like I had the better game plan and the fact that I got mine on my back, shoulder blade. And I did not go with anything that was a solid black color, right? I picked a cartoon character. So if anybody can imagine me, I have a Looney Tune on my back, right? So all the other guys were getting Grim Reapers and, rolling paper logos and dumb stuff, and I thought, in 40 years, I'm going to have to live with myself.
I had a patient who had profanities tattooed all over his body. This was he was at the free clinic, very nice, father of two, and I looked at him and asked him, why do you have all those profanities? He says, I used to be a lot angrier. So life,
does that count as saying them?
Life does change, and this very nice man, his body was yelling obscenities at me that he apparently did not mean. We're not going to yell any obscenities at you. We're going to let you take a break. And we'll come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the RIP Lawrence Weed show for Dr. Lawrence Weed, who recently passed away, but back in the 1970s had a great deal of influence on how doctors record their findings when they do your examination and they see you, and had a lot of influence on my life. I never met him, but one of my partners, Yule Scott, worked at the same place that he did for time and was a real disciple of Lawrence Weed. our sponsor for the second time, the Know Your Internal Organs Working Cluster. I worked with a group at the American Association of Medical College, and they had reorganized themselves into working clusters. And I thought that was funny. A working cluster just does not sound like it's going to accomplish anything.
Would you rather have a non-working cluster?
I'm not sure there's much difference. that cluster is working like crazy here. I don't know.
See, IT, we use the word cluster all the time. Sometimes we overuse cluster.
I think you do.
Because we build things in cluster.
See, cluster makes me giggle. So if you say I'm in a cluster, I'm thinking, well, you must be in pretty bad shape.
Yeah.
You're in the middle of a cluster.
I think, well, yeah. So you're adding a word to the end.
No, I'm not. Cluster does not inspire confidence. If Donald Trump creates a cluster to deal with our problems in Syria, I am not confident.
What if it's a peanut cluster?
I'll eat it. I'm still not confident. Just saying. But this is the Know Your Internal Organs Working Cluster.
We technically, the three of us, are a cluster.
Today's organ, we are not. Today's organ, the liver. If you want to live, you need a liver. And I'll remind you, we're going through our 11 fun facts about the liver. Number one, it's the largest organ in the human body. Next to the brain, performs the most distinct functions. Reminding you, number two, the Elizabethans referred to their monarch as the liver of the state rather than the head of the state. Number three, lily liver used first in 1605. From the belief that the liver was the seat of courage and a pale liver indicated a coward. Number four, there is no artificial liver. We have not developed the technology to replace the liver. Number five, it's the only organ in the adult body that after being chopped down can regenerate and perform as if new. Number six now, the liver performs more than 300 tasks, second in number only to the brain. That includes neutralizing potentially harmful substances we put in our bodies, regulating body chemistry, generating hormones, enzymes, converting food into building blocks for cells. Number seven, one recent study of mice found the liver grows and shrinks up to 40% over the course in 24 hours. Now, I did not know that. I was taught when I examined the liver to check for liver size. They did not mention that the liver size might change by up to 40%. This was a study in mice, but apparently the human liver also changes size by a substantial amount. I really was not aware of that. Number eight, metabolically active cells that make up 80% of the liver, they can have up to 8 sets of chromosomes without becoming cancerous. That means these cells can divide and differentiate, sort of like the cells in your immune system. It's absolutely remarkable. Marcus Grumpy, who is at Oregon Health and Science University, and I'm sorry, Marcus, I'm sure I mispronounced your name. He called that super unique. It explains a lot of the regenerative ability of the liver, the fact that they have all these sets of chromosomes. Number nine, he and other researchers have shown that the cell's ability to handle multiple sets of chromosomes make them like immune cells. We mentioned that. Number 10, it may play a prominent role in appetite and food preference. Research published in May of this year indicated that after exposure to a sugary drink, the liver seeks to curb further sugar indulgence by releasing a hormone called fibroblast growth factor 21. A mutant version of that was associated with a sweet tooth. So it may be your liver that's causing your problems.
Sweet liver, not a sweet tooth.
Yeah, nothing to do with teeth. Over 100 disorders can affect the liver. We'll talk more about that in our third and final fractional portion. That is our sponsor, the Know Your Internal Organs Working Cluster. If you want to live, you need a liver. Now, this next piece of research is going to take a while to set up, but I think it will be fun to set up. And I will take that time. This was from my new favorite journal, a journal called Appetite. And the title of this, which we put, by the way, on our Facebook page, Consumption of Garlic Positively Affects Hedonic Perception of Axillary Body Odor. Now, those are big journal words. What it means is you eat the garlic and women go wild over your underarm smell. That's essentially what we're saying. And they have proved this scientifically. So this is no longer a matter of conjecture. This is not something to be debated, Rick. This is absolutely true. First of all, in the introduction of the article, they point out the problem with garlic is there is an unpleasant garlic breath and body odor. And I don't know how they did that in their introduction, and then they got to the point where women went wild. But that's, I mean, you know, you never know. Concentrations of sulfur-containing gases decreased finally after 3 hours after you ate garlic, except there was allyl methyl sulfide. That was the predominant sulfur gas present in your breath. And ladies and gentlemen, having sulfur gases in your breath is not the way you necessarily win friends and influence people. But that's what happens. It turns out the garlic consumption may affect the odor of human breast milk. after ingestion of garlic capsules by breastfeeding women. The odor of breast milk was perceived by adult panelists. These people are on a panel.
Exactly. How did they
as more intense? Infants spent more time attached to their mother's breast. So apparently the infants like the garlic milk. Yeah. And so that was
that like garlic butter? I mean, come on, man. I don't know. That's
no
weird.
This whole article is strange. We haven't even gotten past the introduction
is
yet.
Is this what you read at work?
Listen, once you find a summary of this article, you've got to read the whole thing. So I read the whole thing. And here's what happened. Section 2.1.1, odor donors. That's right. We have the odor donors. There were 10 men. Average age was 25. They are our odor
donors.
You
sure their average age wasn't 11?
They were students at Charles University in Prague.
Researchers.
They had another 16 men, average age 25, took part in the second part of it, and 16 men in the third part. And these were all university students, average age 25. The donors were given $20. Keep that in mind. They were given $20 to donate their odor. Now, they had 14 women. Their average age was around 25 as well. They took part in the first study. 40 women, age 22 average, took part in the second, and 28 in the third part of the study. The women were given $5. So men donate their underarm sweat. They were given $20. And they did. They had to go home. They had to wear a pad for 24 hours to collect the underarm sweat and so forth. But the women had to smell it, and they only got $5. So this is it. The men, they donated, the women smelled, and this is what they did. And, in the first study, you'll love this, the women, the first time around, they got a chocolate bar.
A chocolate bar.
Yeah. Said, hey, would you smell some pads of men's underarms? I'll give you a chocolate bar.
Does that work?
I don't know. I got one in the van. Come on down to the van. We'll get a chocolate bar.
No.
And then apparently the
You're
chocolate
terrible.
Bar. The chocolate bar didn't work, so they gave him $5. They said, okay.
To go buy a chocolate bar.
Well, you could have more than one chocolate bar. So there were three groups of men. These were the odor donors. The first group ate a slice of bread with 6 grams of crushed garlic. That's the daily recommendation for garlic, apparently. And, they ate a slice of bread with garlic and cheese. And you mentioned it, garlic butter, but this is garlic and cheese. And then the group B just ate a slice of bread with butter, and so they didn't have any garlic. That didn't really impress the women too much, apparently. So they went to study two. They doubled the dose to 12 grams of garlic and cheese on a slice of bread. My favorite meal, 12 grams of garlic. That's about 4 cloves of fresh garlic on a slice of bread with some cheese. And then in the third study, they just apparently gave up, and they gave them 12 capsules, garlic capsules, 1,000 milligrams each. Others got just blank capsules. They fixed a cotton pad. They taped a cotton pad 9 by 7 centimeters. That's a pretty decent-sized pad, to an armpit using surgical tape. They left the laboratory, and they continued to wear the pads for 12 hours. So you're walking around for 12 hours with and you can't shave your armpits, so basically you've got this pad taped to your armpit and pulling on your arm hair for 12 hours. They gave them a new T-shirt to wear because they didn't want the shirts, the laundry detergent, and the fabric softeners and so forth. They got a new cotton T-shirt out of it, plus $20. I mean, the men are really making out here pretty well. Then the ratings took place in a quiet, ventilated room, as we should always have when we're smelling armpit hair.
Oh, my goodness.
So they gave the women two pads at a time. You know, one was from a garlic guy, one was from a non-garlic guy. And they got to smell those. And they assessed these pairs. And they were asked to rate it on a 7-point scale for pleasantness, attractiveness, masculinity, and intensity. 7-point scale. Now, this is the way it works. And I know you're all wondering, what happened? Here's what they did. No significant differences in the ratings of any characteristics in study one. The 6 grams of garlic didn't do anything. But when you get to 12 grams, the odor of the donors after an increased garlic dosage was significantly more pleasant, more attractive, and less intense, in the third study, which was the garlic capsules. They said, our results indicate that garlic consumption may have positive effects on perceived body odor hedonicity. That is, the women loved the body odor of the garlic people. And perhaps their thinking is women knew that garlic was healthy, and so they associate garlic with healthy men.
Do you buy that?
No. In no way. I think if
doesn't it just make it seem like they eat at the Olive Garden?
Well, here's the thing. You've got these two pads, and one of them smells sweaty, and one of them smells faintly of garlic.
One of them smells sweaty and faintly of garlic.
Okay, but right. If you've got a little bit of garlic, it's a little bit less sweaty. I mean, let's face it. If I thought that human sweat smelled better, underarm sweat smelled better than any food, I need to have my nose examined.
I think we're grossing people out.
Possibly.
Well, I mean, I want you to understand how
science
is done.
I feel bad for the people driving down the road right now listening to you talk about odor.
I hope they don't have any pizza in the car.
Well, just think, for a chocolate bar, you could be part of that study.
No, I couldn't.
Oh, my goodness. Where do you get this stuff?
I got it summarized, and they said, garlic, garlic makes you smell better. And I thought, no, it doesn't. And they said, these women think
it does. People sell breath mints because of garlic.
Now, the thing is, garlic makes you smell better than your underarm sweat. I think I
so. It's
might,
relative.
I might be able to accept that your underarm smell.
There are probably other things it smells better than.
Yeah, garlic smells better than some stuff. So yeah, sure. That's the whole idea of a potpourri.
Just not fruit and vegetables, and daisies.
Okay. We got 6 minutes.
You're fresh as a daisy, Tony.
Let's talk for a minute about traveling. Because
are we leaving garlic?
We are leaving garlic, and many of us are leaving the country, and so. And so we ought to talk a little bit about travel, and I want to give you some advice that we've accumulated over the years about travel. So I'm going to start. This was the thing that made me do this. They have best advice for patients for travel, June 7, 2017. And they said, the number one best advice for travelers is it's important to keep mosquitoes at bay. If you are, in fact, traveling anywhere where there might be mosquitoes are bad news in 2017. A lot of the places where they just used to make a bump and no big deal, they are now carrying diseases that you really don't want to get. I mean, we know certainly yellow fever and malaria in some areas of the world, but even in the Caribbean area, even along the Gulf Coast, we're worried about Zika virus. We've got chikungunya still in the Caribbean, not as common as it was. We've got West Nile virus in the United States. So pretty much anywhere you travel, you should have something to some way of repelling mosquitoes. They mentioned, secondly, you start with the basics on immunization. A flu shot if you're traveling during flu season. A tetanus shot if you haven't had one. Again, if you have not had one in 10 years, you're due a tetanus booster. We do that on the 10s, 40, 50, 60, and so forth. If you are like Rick and me and you do stupid on a regular basis, you need to have one every 5 years. It's just, and we will stumble into the emergency
room. Well, I mean, the ER makes us have it because we can't remember if we had it or not.
Right, that works perfectly well, but that's the way real men get their tetanus shot, is to stumble in the ER and get their wound flushed out and then get a tetanus shot. Mm-hmm. And also, they mentioned mumps, measles, and rubella. The MMR vaccination, half of the adults who need the MMR vaccine in pre-travel clinics actually receive it. So keep that in mind and talk with your doctor about whether you need that or not. The other one, and this is them, not me talking, Sandra Addison Freihofer, MD, published this, Staying Healthy While Traveling. She said hepatitis A vaccination is a must for all international travelers. Hepatitis A, again, it is a disease of the liver spread by contaminated food, and the single-dose vaccine is about 94% effective. Hepatitis A does not lead to long-term hepatitis, almost never does, but you don't want to get hepatitis A. It's really uncomfortable. So hepatitis A vaccine. Hepatitis B vaccination, if you should also be considered. Hepatitis B is bloodborne. Again, if you get into an accident, fighting with someone, things like that, you cross blood, you could get into trouble there. South Asia has the highest typhoid risk, and that's one that you might want to think about as well. Meningitis is a threat in sub-Saharan Africa, and so, matter of fact, they mentioned Saudi Arabia requires vaccination for meningitis if you are undertaking the Hajj. Think about those vaccines, but the basic thing of avoiding mosquitoes or having a way to repel mosquitoes and getting a hepatitis A vaccine, those are basic things. Now, here's the thing, and this is good advice. Monkeys and native animals are cute, but don't feed them, don't touch them. Remember, rabies. Any pets, any unknown animals, including dogs, never assume that an animal is rabies-free when you're traveling. Because this is something that is vanishingly rare in the U.S., but in other countries, rabies is still a problem. They said don't go bicycling or running in a high-risk rabies area. you're going to attract attention from a rabid animal if you do that. So plan your routes carefully and make sure you know about rabies in the area. If you get bitten, scratched, or even licked on broken skin, go immediately seek post-exposure prophylaxis. Rabies, once again, nothing you want to get caught up with. And check the CDC travel site. That's that is a useful thing as far as infection. And one of the things they mentioned is if you are used to driving on the right side and this country is on the left side, your risk of car crashes goes up substantially. Mm-hmm. You ever driven a car on the left side, Rick?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Was it tough?
It took about 4 hours to maybe not 4 hours. Maybe it took about four trips, you know, maybe 20 minutes a trip. And then you finally started to feel comfortable. The left turns are equivalent to our right turns, pretty easy. Right turns are difficult.
Yeah, we would. I did it once, and we would pull up to an intersection, and then my wife and I would debate. And
that's exactly what we did.
Yeah,
we mapped it out together and said, "Okay, it looks like you could go over there."
Yeah. And it's surprising how long it takes. No. Yeah. Well, wait. Wait a minute.
Well, nope. There's a car. Yeah. Go. Oh, wait a minute. They're going the wrong direction. They're not going to be in our way.
Yeah. That's the other thing. You figure this other car. You think, well, now, wait a minute. What is he doing? And it can be difficult. But remember that. I mean, the simple things. Don't do stupid things. Don't do stupid things. Take a break. Come back for our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the RIP Lawrence Weed Show. Our salute again to a legendary physician, a man far ahead of his time, Dr. Lawrence Weed, who passed away earlier this month. Our sponsor for the final time, the liver. And I'm going to race through these 11 fun facts about the liver, and I will tell you why, among many reasons, we are talking about the liver today. Fun fact number one is the largest organ in the human body, has the most distinct functions next to the brain. Number two, the Elizabethans called the head of state, called their monarch the liver of state. The first known use of the word lily-livered was in 1605. We do not have a mechanical liver. There is no way you can hook yourself to an artificial liver. Number five, it's the only organ that can regenerate and perform as if brand new. Number six, it performs more than 300 tasks. Number seven, liver grows and shrinks by up to 40% over the course of 24 hours. An astonishing fact to me, who has spent my life trying to feel people's liver, I am surprised that it changes in size that much. Number eight, metabolically active cells that make up 80% of the liver can have up to eight sets of chromosomes. That means they can change function. They can change the way they work. And that also helps them with their regenerative ability. Number nine, that's what that says. And number 10, it may also play a role in appetite and food preference, according to research published in May. It does, if you take in large amounts of sugary drinks, it will in fact, secrete a hormone to try to dampen your sweet tooth. If that hormone is defective, you will love sweet things. And number 11, which is where we start from, over 100 disorders can affect the liver. Now, liver and bile duct cancer are the fifth and eighth leading cause of cancer death in men and women. 41,000 cancer deaths due to liver disease, 29,000 due to bile duct disease in 2017. That's the estimates. The death rates are increasing at a faster pace than any other cancer. Death rates have doubled since the 1980s from liver cancer. So you say to yourself, why did the death rates double? Is it some kind of new plastic pollution something or other?
Twice hormone as many people
disruptor
died.
That doubled our death rates. In fact, the biggest thing is hepatitis C. We, unfortunately, are a generation who enjoyed IV drugs, and as a part of IV drugs, we swapped needles, and as a part of swapping needles, we swapped hepatitis C. This is a very, very almost asymptomatic, no symptoms, hepatitis. So you don't know you've got it. It sets and it inflames the liver for years and years and years until it leads to liver cancer. Average 19 years of life are lost per death because of the young age. 63 years is the average age at which people develop liver cancer. And it looks like it's going to continue to rise at least through 2030, even if we do something sensible about hepatitis C, which so far we have not seemed to be able to do. It is the CDC, for this is one of the many reasons the CDC has recommended that every baby boomer, everyone born between ages between the years 1945 and 1965, be tested for hepatitis C infection. The other things that lead to liver cancer, obesity and type 2 diabetes lead to fatty change in the liver. Cigarette smoking does increase your risk of liver cancer, and so does heavy alcohol use. So we have a marvelous organ, an organ that can do just about anything. The one thing it can't do is overcome things like hepatitis C, obesity, cigarettes, and alcohol. So our lifestyle puts our livers in danger, and we are falling prey to liver cancer at an ever-increasing rate. Be careful. Take care of your liver, and it will take care of you. That is our sponsor, the Know Your Internal Organs Working Cluster. Speaking of smoking, I thought I knew just about everything about smoking. I've spent my life combating smoking and talking about lung cancer, and I read in this article, the Washington Post, June 14th, something that I went back and got the original sources, and I found something that I'd really not heard before. It starts off positive. We've done something that once seemed impossible. Most of the United States has quit smoking. Millions of lives, massive reductions in our cancer burden. We are down.
Wasn't that way when we started 14 years ago?
No, not at all.
We've single-handedly.
We will take credit for the entire thing because we on Health Matters have a campaign.
Well,
for
this
a long
is
time.
One where I think I'm going to let you take all the credit.
Yeah, I will. I did most of the talking. You agreed, but still, you were there back.
I didn't always agree.
I know. Well, but you didn't argue too vociferously, especially when it came to smoking. So I think you can share in the credit for reducing our nation's burden of cigarettes. I'll give that. Shelley, you weren't there.
No, I wasn't there. Yeah. Nope.
But the national rate is down now. I think 16% was the number I saw. Utah, the lowest state in the nation in terms of smoking, around 9% or less. Kentucky, West Virginia, and our bordering states, we swap now the highest. We're not always the highest, but we're sitting around 26-27% as a state. But that hides something that I was not aware of. 26% as a state. If you look at our college graduates in the state of Kentucky, they are running around 10% smoking rates.
Yeah.
If you look at people who either finished high school or didn't finish high school and did not have any college education, 50% smoking rate. Mm-hmm. 50%. And so what's happening then is we've known for a long time that lung cancer seems selectively to be affecting people who are poor and people who are rural. And in this case, there is a big difference in the smoking rates between our wealthiest Kentuckians, our most educated Kentuckians, and our poorest. Mm-hmm. Nationally, the smoking rate's over 40% for those with high school equivalency diploma, according to the CDC. Lung cancer rates in rural residents, 18-20% above those of city dwellers. And again, we see our rates here. Every county in the state of Kentucky has a higher rate than the national average for diagnosing lung cancer. But within that, within the counties, there is easily a 30% difference between our highest rates and or more, our highest rates and our lowest rates within the state. So, and once again, the lowest rates are going to be around Lexington, around Louisville, and the higher rates are going to be more in eastern Kentucky and in rural Kentucky. So there it is. We have made a great progress toward eliminating cigarette smoking, but we are leaving the poorest and the least educated people behind. And this is part of the struggles we see in rural Kentucky. You know, that's the area, Rick, where we have not had the impact
right.
as a show.
Kentucky's shown some improvement, but not near what the rest of the country. Now, to Kentucky's, you know, as part of the rationalization for this, the rest of the country wasn't dependent on tobacco as their primary income source, right? So, I mean, I think we faced a larger battle trying to determine how not to live off the revenue of tobacco. And that you know, I'm sorry, Colorado, but you just didn't have to do that. Neither did Idaho. I mean, so Utah can't even grow tobacco. I mean, you know, so much less. These aren't the same problem. So it's probably easier to say, okay, well, this is unhealthy. Let's quit doing that. But people here were convinced that if they quit doing it, their livelihood was going to be impacted. that they were given in to the fact that what they've been doing their whole life, you know, and generations and generations was going to go down in flames, and they were going to, I mean, it was a livelihood thing. So, yeah, we had a tough battle, Tony.
After I finished my medical education, I came back home to Kentucky in 1986. In 1988, the Greater Cincinnati Airport, which is in northern Kentucky, decided that they would go smoke-free indoors. And the Kentucky legislature's response was to threaten to revoke their liquor license if they did so. This was the kind of, as you mentioned, Rick, not only the concern for the tobacco farmer, but also the legislative protection of Kentucky's cash crop. It was our leading legal cash crop for many, many years, until the fallout from the tobacco settlement when the tobacco companies basically dropped out of the price support system. But our tobacco, we made a lot of money off tobacco, and our legislature was bound and determined to protect tobacco from all assaults, including smoke-free areas. This still is amazing to me. Between the time I got here in 1986 and around 1992 or so, the first 5 or 6 years I was here, the hospital allowed smoking absolutely anywhere except where oxygen was in use. You could smoke basically on the obstetrics ward. You could smoke with your newborn baby. And certainly the waiting room for the obstetrics service there was a cesspool. I would come to work, and I could see the air that I breathed. It was blue-tinged smoke on a sunny day. You could see the smoke rolling in the hallways. There were burns on the mattresses, burns on the patient gowns. It is hard to imagine in this day and age a hospital which allowed that degree of smoking, and there was cigarette smoke absolutely everywhere. We've got work to do, though. Frankly, we've eliminated it from hospitals and here in Moorhead from indoor spaces, indoor public spaces. Many communities across the state have done the same. Our legislature has not increased our tobacco tax now for years, and we need to get our tobacco tax higher to prevent young people from starting. And also, we have steadfastly refused to even bring a smoking ban in front of the legislature for consideration. It has been bottled up in committee every legislative session for the past 3 or 4 sessions and seems to be going nowhere in the near future as well. So you wind up then, we in Kentucky, losing a greater percentage of our population to lung cancer than any other state in the nation, and we can't take these simple measures that we know other states have proven would curb our smoking habit. And unfortunately, the people who are doing it are those that are least educated, least able to afford both the cigarettes and the health effects of them. It is a sad state that we live in. Next up, speaking of cancer, this is from the Journal of Oncology Practice. The cost of treating cancer, that's about 1.7 million Americans in 2017 will have cancer. The cost is skyrocketing. The average cost of a year of cancer treatment in 2000 was less than $10,000. By 2005, it was up to $30,000 to $50,000. In 2012, 12 out of the 13 newly approved drugs for cancer cost more than $100,000 per year. So we have gone from, in the year 2000, $10,000 to, in current times, a cost approaching $100,000 per year for cancer treatment.
Well, and you have to believe we're screening more, so we're finding more. So you have to believe the whole thing is not only have the costs gone up, but the numbers have had to have gone up.
The comments in the Journal of Oncology Practice is insurance companies desperate to clamp down on their own expenses, cut reimbursements for more expensive drugs, and employers push employees into high-deductible insurance plans, more of this cost ends up being picked up by patients. Now, we've said this over and over again. If you have cancer, the chances of you finishing your course of chemotherapy have dropped dramatically because people simply can't afford the pills. This is the country. This is the healthcare system we live in, which is why on this show, we will continue to talk about this because this is deplorable. People dying. Some of these cancers are not curable. It may not be the difference between cure and dying, but many of them actually are. And for the ones, even the ones that aren't curable, life can be prolonged by these medications if a person can afford them. And when it comes down to do you, in fact, sell your family home, mortgage your family's future to get an extra few months from treating your cancer, my decision would be pretty obvious on that. I would not do that. I spent my life trying to take care of my family. I'm not going to, in the last month of my life or last few months of my life, take away all the things that I've built up for my family. Mm-hmm. I would check out early if I had to do that.
Yeah, I don't know, Tony. That's a tough one because I think, you know, I'd like to think that I agree with you 100% and I'd like to think I'm right there with you. But, you know, you're staring at your family and you know you can get a few more months. I mean, it's probably an extremely difficult thing to do, right? I think you may have to spend your entire life planning for that mental exercise.
I think you have to really look at this thing and ask yourself, what are you getting for the chemotherapy? And what are you giving up for the chemotherapy?
You're getting hope.
It does, yes.
And that, I mean, it's hard. That's a hard discussion to have. I mean, it doesn't matter whether the odds are 5% or 95%. The hope is there. And so we're willing to defy the odds. I mean, let's face it. The alternative isn't what we're interested in.
With our healthcare system, people shouldn't have to make this decision in the first place. I will tell you, I've thought it through because I've seen so many patients. I know you have too, Shelley.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not sure a lot of these patients even have a choice. There are no resources. They have nothing to leverage to get the treatment, even if it is curable.
And they also, they don't have access to advice. You know, it's quite simple. You take this pill. If you want to treat your cancer, you take this pill. If you don't want to treat this cancer, don't come back to my office. Mm-hmm. No one says, all right, well, you know, what are you getting for your money on this and how much are you giving up? That type of dialogue is not being held. But it is real. Some of these chemotherapies are absolutely life-saving. Some are not. All of them, 12 out of 13 of the new ones, whether they cured the cancer or at least sent it into remission, or whether they gave you an extra 6 weeks or something like that, they're all over $100,000 for a year's supply. And a lot of these are medicines you use to treat myeloma and tumors of the bone marrow and the lymph system and so forth. But these we've talked about with hepatitis. These drugs are just outrageously and unethically expensive. And unfortunately, then we have to make these decisions, which is we are not prepared at all to do. Frustration.
Wow. You got anything happy we can talk about?
Yeah. I thought you might like this one. As a matter of fact, let's end on a happy note. Let's talk about drones. We know if you go into a cardiac arrest. Yes. Well, thank you. That was – are you proud of yourself?
I am.
That was pretty good.
But you know what? Nobody's listening at this point anyway. So what does it matter?
I know. I've got them all so depressed.
They've all turned off.
In the corner weeping. I know. But here we go. All right. So if you go into a cardiac arrest, and this is going to turn out happy. Trust me.
I really would prefer not to go down this road if it's okay.
You need an electric shock. And the sooner you get shocked, the better off. If you're shocked within 1 minute of collapse, your survival is nearly 90%. But 10 minutes, it drops to actually below 5%. So those first 10 minutes are absolutely critical. How do you get a defibrillator? We've started stocking them in some places, but we can't figure out where is the best place to have it. What if you collapse on the street and there's not a defibrillator handy? We're going to call 911.
I'm going to listen to Health Matters.
And the ambulance is going to... I'm talking with the producer about a soundproof booth. I think it's time for those comments need to be just edited out. That's all there is to it. but at any rate, how do you get that defibrillator? Well, the Karolinska Institute people in Stockholm, they developed a drone that carries and drops a defibrillator, and it looks like it can beat the ambulances. The drone, 12 and a half pounds, 8 rotors, speeds of 47 miles per hour. That's a little scary. It uses GPS system, autopilot software, and high-definition camera, and it can get to anywhere in the city, essentially. They first modeled whether or not they would be able to do better with a drone than an ambulance. They would beat the ambulance 93% of the time. Then they did this really neat study where they said, all right, we're going to put a drone in a fire station. We're going to dispatch it to 18 locations in Stockholm where people suffered an actual cardiac arrest away from the hospital between 2006 and 2014. So they knew the locations of the cardiac arrest, and they said, we're just going to fly to each one of those and send an ambulance as well. And the drone, every time, drone beat the ambulances. There was no doubt about it. Hopefully, if you happen to have a cardiac arrest in the future, there will be a drone buzzing by with a defibrillator, and you will be able to be defibrillated in time. Meanwhile, we need to get off the air in time.
I hope the drone doesn't run out of battery before it gets to me. But that's a topic for another show. Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producers, Sean Delaney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to our show, go to WMKY.org or just visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
Health Matters is a first and only once-a-week radio show that works in two ways in the brain to help fight the symptoms of moderate to severe Alzheimer's disease. Before listening to Health Matters, tell your doctor about all of your medical conditions, including
heart problems, including an irregular, slow, or fast heartbeat,
asthma or lung problems,
seizures,
stomach ulcers,
bladder, kidney, or liver problems,
any surgical, dental, or other medical procedures scheduled when anesthesia may be used.
What are the possible side effects of Health Matters?
Health Matters may cause serious side effects, including
muscle problems in patients given anesthesia,
slow heartbeat and fainting. This happens more often in people with heart problems. Call the doctor right away if you faint while listening to our show.
More stomach acid. This raises the chance of ulcers and bleeding, especially when listening to Health Matters. The risk is higher for patients who have had ulcers or take aspirin or other NSAIDs.
Nausea and vomiting.
Difficulty passing urine.
Seizures.
Worsening of lung problems in people with asthma or other lung disease.
The most common side effects of the first fractional portion include headache, diarrhea, and dizziness.
Most common side effects of the second fractional portion include diarrhea, not wanting to eat, and bruising.
These are not all the possible side effects for Health Matters. We do have a third and final fractional portion.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get out this week. Make a healthy change in your life and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.